Call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is Monday, March 11, 2019. Time is 1:38 p.m. Before we begin, I want to thank Robert Montenegro, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Madison Truitt from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Wool, Representative Kopp, Representative Shaw, Representative Stutes, and myself, Representative Clayman. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is a confirmation hearing. The speaker referred the governor's appointee to the Judiciary Committee, the Commissioner of the Department of Corrections. Members have received the appointee's resume, and the appointee is present and willing and available to testify. So you will open public testimony. Ms. Dahlstrom, if you would like to please come forward, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm happy to be here. My name is Nancy Dahlstrom, and I'll give you a little bit of background about myself for those of you that don't know me. I've been in Alaska for nearly 40 years. My husband and I have four children that are all Alaska-raised, and we have 10 grandchildren. Throughout my professional life, I've had the opportunity to serve in both the public and private sector, and as you know, I had the privilege of representing Eagle River for 8 years. I'm here before you today because the governor asked me to serve as the Commissioner of Corrections, and it was an honor to accept his offer. It's no secret to any of you that I don't have a corrections background, but it's also no secret that this administration isn't doing business as usual. And what I do have is a professional and educational skill set to be successful in this position.
I would just note that Representative Ledoux has also joined us. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My ability to identify both problems and opportunities and to create a path to address them, to build a successful team to implement and ultimately execute the decisions, makes me the right choice for the job. It's a position that I take very seriously. I feel the responsibility of it, and I am up for the task. My department has three mission things that I'm extremely concerned about, and they're very important to me. And those visions and goals are, one, that we need to make sure that all of our employees and everyone in the institutions is safe. That's inmates and all employees. The reentry programs are very important to me. We need to help inmates transition back into society successfully. And ongoing recruitment and retention efforts are important. We need to attract and retain qualified employees, and this includes correctional officers, probation officers, nurses, and medical staff. So I'll tell you just a little bit more. I've been on the job just a couple months, but I've already made some changes. Several policies were suspended or amended in order to bring attention back to where it belongs, and that's the focus on the safety of the inmates and the employees, and honoring and recognizing victims' rights. I'm also committed to programs that help our incarcerated reintegrate into society whenever possible. I do know and I recognize that people make mistakes, and through many of our programs, whether they be faith-based, work-based, substance abuse, domestic violence counseling, that they can then have a chance to be proud law-abiding citizens again. I've brought on a new team member this past week who has extensive experience in criminal justice and reentry, and her primary focus is going to be on reentry. DOC has a dedicated staff of 1,900 men and women. It's no secret that hiring and retaining these employees can be difficult. I've created a dedicated group to address this issue head on and come up with ideas and proposals, and we are actively working on that. In closing, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today. I do look forward to answering your questions, and I am happy and willing to serve the people in the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Ms. Dahlstrom. It's time for questions from the committee. It is my practice to limit those questions, so 1 minute per question. Are there questions for Ms. Dahlstrom? Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. Nice to see you. Nice to meet you for the first time. I do have a question. If I'm correct, I have read where the Department of Corrections is anticipating sending some of our prisoners out of state. And I'm curious as to how you think that will be cost savings. I was just reading about another state that did the very same thing, and it ended up costing that state three times as much as it would have cost them if they had they kept them in state. So, you know, it would make a person a little apprehensive.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Stutes, for that question. The governor's budget did contain a line that says sending 500 inmates out, and it is a cost-saving measure. I can't speak to the actual dollars at the moment. My ASD has handled that in working with OMB, but I will tell you that I am always open to information and learning new things, and if you have information to share, I would like to read it, but it's currently an item in the governor's budget.
Thank you for that. I'll see if I can put my fingers on it and forward it to you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions for Ms. Dahlstrom? I actually have some questions if no one else does. You talked some about the reentry programs and your commitment to the reentry programs, and one of the early decisions from your administration was to turn down the federal Second Chance grant. Can you tell me about, from the beginning stages of the grant, how many other states applied for that grant?
Mr. Chair, I cannot tell you that. I don't know.
Do you have any idea about how long the strategic planning portion of the grant was to last?
Mr. Chair, the grant was for 1 year.
Which part of the grant was for 1 year, if you know?
Mr. Chair, the information I have is that the $1 million for 1 year was for 1 year. Nearly half of that was to hire personnel. And at the end of the year, we could have applied. We may or may not have received it again. I didn't feel it was sustainable to bring on several new employees and then have to let them go, or they would need to be absorbed into state government.
I guess it may not be appropriate for this hearing, but it may be appropriate. Maybe this committee will do some further investigation, because at least the additional research I've done suggests that there was a $100,000 strategic planning grant. Alaska was one of only five states to receive the $100,000 grant, and that the $1 million grant was actually a 3-year grant and not a 1-year grant, and the 3-year grant for the $1 million actually involved very little hiring of state employees and was more directed toward reentry services. Now, it sounds like you don't know a lot of details about this grant.
Mr. Chair, if I might, when you asked the question, I thought you were speaking directly to the $1 million grant. There are two grants. It's can be confusing because they're both the same name, the Second Chance Act. One of them was a $100,000 grant, which we did accept, and it was matched with $100,000 from the state of Alaska. At present, we have used $10,000 of that, and that $10,000 was used before I got here to send two people to Washington, D.C. and back. The rest is we're still looking at where is the best way to use it. The information that I have is that the $1 million grant is the one that required the extra staff.
And your understanding, as we sit here today, is that was only for 1 year?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
And so the other sources I contacted that suggested it was a 3-year grant, that wasn't your understanding?
Mr. Chair, you're correct. That my understanding, it's a 1 year.
All right. Well, I'm frankly, from all the information I've heard about the reentry grant and been a lot more information from other folks I've heard from, I'm still very concerned about how that decision was made to turn down that federal money, because it sounds like it's very directed towards the very reentry services that you're an advocate for, and turning that money away seems like it really doesn't serve anyone any good. And we were apparently one of only five states to get the strategic planning grant and only three states to get the other grant. And so it was a competitive process, and Alaska was doing well. And were you aware of those competitive applications when you turned down this grant?
Mr. Chair, I was not involved in the process at that time, no.
And so the decision to turn that into a grant was actually made, that wasn't a decision that you made, it was made by others in the administration?
Mr. Chair, that's incorrect. I fully made the decision myself, and I made it based on bringing people on that I felt I would have to let go very shortly.
All right. Well, as I think I've been pretty clear that I'm pretty unhappy with that decision. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dahlstrom, what are your thoughts on the efficacy of private prisons?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, are you speaking about sending prisoners out, or are you speaking about bringing people in here to run our prisons?
I'm referring to the latter. People coming in here to run our prisons as a private through a private corporation.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I can tell you that I have not had one discussion with anyone about that.
Follow up. Yeah, I guess my question isn't so much that, but what is your thought in general about that concept, and do you think it's something that is worth looking into?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I'm always open to facts and looking and learning, but I feel that the department can do a very good job running our facilities.
Thank you.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. I'm going to follow up on my earlier question. Is didn't the state at one time, and maybe you don't know this, and this might not be a very fair question, didn't they at one time, excuse me, send prisoners out of state? And I don't know what the issue was or why it didn't work necessarily, and then they brought them all back. So I just find it curious if the state is again contemplating sending people outside.
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, you are correct. The state did send prisoners out previously, and then they were brought back. Both times it was legislative decisions. So there is a lot of some history there to learn from.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Through the chair. So are you telling me it would be a legislative decision to send prisoners outside once again?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, no. And if I misspoke, if that's what I said, it's a line item in the governor's budget to send 500 prisoners out. However, the Commissioner of Department of Corrections has always had the authority to be able to do that.
Follow-up.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. My last follow-up. Are you in favor of sending prisoners out of state?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, I am going to follow through with a budget that's given to me, and if I am directed to do so, I will do that.
Follow-up.
Representative Stutes.
Wasn't quite right when I said
we're
last.
Not counting yet.
Thank you. Well, you just previously said it's at the discretion of the commissioner. So I'm asking you if you personally are in favor of sending inmates out of state.
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, I'm here representing the governor's views on his budget.
Please.
Representative Stutes, I'm not sure she's going to answer the question that you wanted to answer, but you can try one more time.
The question that I'm asking, you as the commissioner, aside from the governor, I understand that you're an employee of the governor's and that he's the bottom line. Are you in favor of sending prisoners out of state?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, I will say that I was not contemplating sending prisoners out till it came to me in the budget.
That'll work. Thank you.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Nancy Dahlstrom, for being willing to take on this job. And I appreciate the spot you're in, too. And I have no doubt you'll be effective in your role as administrator over the system. What is your view about the effectiveness of faith-based programs run in a prison system now?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, I have seen in my short time here successes from the faith-based programs. I've talked with inmates, families, correctional officers, and also with people who are facilitating the program in several of the different facilities, and I believe that they are very effective.
Follow-up.
Have you seen any data that actually supports that the recidivism is lower among those people that successfully complete those programs versus other programs?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, I need to get back with you on that. I've seen so much data on different programs. I don't want to confuse them.
Okay.
Representative Kopp, follow up.
Uh, The data I've seen shows that they are remarkably effective. Contacts with the guards at different facilities say that people rarely come back, that come through. So question is, are you committed to continuing like the Transformational Living Center program?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, yes, I am. And we have it actively going at Anchorage Correctional, and the women's TLC program is running at Highland Mountain. And I would like to see those programs, as well as substance abuse, the work programs, all those things extended throughout the program and growing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. It was recently brought to my attention that there have been some changes that are being made to those faith-based programs. And while I don't have the details yet, I will probably be coming to your office to ask about that. I know there was some concern that some of the gains that have been made may be at risk. My question is more general. If confirmed to this position, what plans, if any, does your office have dealing with drugs in prisons? I know I've heard that that's a concern. I was wondering, is that a concern your office shares? If so, what are the plans to do something about it?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I absolutely share that concern, as well as the other members of my team, and it's something that I have expressed from day one. I have zero tolerance for any officers or employees who might be enabling any type of behavior on that line, and at the same time, we're doing everything we can to make sure that contraband isn't coming into the facilities. People can be very creative on different ways they bring it in, but we are going to continue to do our best with that. And yes, I am committed to decreasing that problem.
Thank you.
Just to follow up on that, and then I'll go to Representative Wolf. In terms of the drugs coming into the prison, you made a decision to disband the Internal Affairs Investigation Unit in the Department of Corrections that had been done by your predecessor, which I believe makes Alaska one of the few, if not the only, state that doesn't have an Internal Affairs Department in Corrections. Why did you do that, and how do you see that as impacting your commitment to try to reduce drugs in the prisons?
Through the chair and members of the committee, I did disband that organization, the reason being that the Alaska State Troopers have statutory authority to investigate all those types of situations. And what was happening is a repetitiveness of services. The unit was reviewing things, and then when something was criminal, they would either turn it over to HR that would start the process so that they could legally check everything out, or turn it over to the Alaska State Troopers, and they had to take the investigation from start to end again so that they covered all bounds. So it was a matter of getting rid of duplication.
What do you make of the fact that other states found that investigation by state police similar to state troopers wasn't particularly effective, and the states that have brought in internal affairs are more successful at the investigations overall in terms of reducing drugs in the prison than not having the internal investigations?
Representative Klayman, I would like to see and read that study before I commented on that.
Okay. Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to resume the line of questioning as Representative Stutes about the exporting or sending prisoners out of state. It was done a while ago, and now it's in the budget, in the current governor's budget. Were either of those times prisoners sent to private prisons, or were they state prisons?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I believe, you know, I don't want to say on record because I don't know.
Follow up.
Representative?
Well, I guess concerning this current budget, for which there is a line item, so therefore there's a dollar amount for the 500 prisoners. So I imagine if there's a dollar amount, someone must have spoken to the other institution to figure out which one it is and how much they charge. So is that a private or a public institution?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, that's incorrect. We have had, after the budget came out, one of my employees in my department made one phone call to an out-of-state institution to see if they had beds available, because we don't know. We didn't know. And so those numbers you would have to ask the ASD and Department of OMB.
Follow up.
Yeah, I guess.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the numbers do exist. Otherwise, it wouldn't really be in the budget, nor would you know if there are actual savings. So the numbers exist somewhere, but the person that made the call, the inquiry that came up with the numbers, is not from your department. Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, Representative Wall, each department has an ASD assigned to it, and mine works directly for OMB, and she is the one that can answer the financial questions on that.
Representative Wall,
do you know which institution she called? You mentioned she called one institution.
Through the chair, Representative Wall, she was not the employee that called. It was after the budget came out, one of my employees, as we were talking about it, said, let's check and see if and where there are beds available.
Okay. Can you tell me who your employee called?
It was an institution in Colorado.
Follow up.
Yeah. Okay. So one of your employees called an institution in Colorado to see if they had beds. Was that a private or a public institution?
Through the chair, Representative Wall, I believe it's a private.
Private. Okay. Thank you.
Any further follow up or questions? Just a couple of others. How many of the prisons in Alaska have you visited since you become corrections commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I believe six.
Which ones were those? I'm not going to hold you to it, just a general sense of where you've been to visit.
Anchorage, of course, Highland. I haven't been to the rural communities. I look forward to doing that. Spring Creek.
Have you been to Wildwood, the prison that's at least slated for partial shutdown?
Mr. Chair, I have not been to Wildwood yet, but I hope to in the next short time.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. I will now see if there's anyone in the room or on the phone that would like to testify with regard to the nomination of Nancy Dahlstrom to the Commissioner of the Department of Corrections. Hearing and seeing no one, I'm going to close public testimony. Are there any additional questions for the nominee? And then we're going to turn to comments. As is the custom, I'll give each member one opportunity for 3 minutes, and I'll call on you all in order. Representative Kopp, you come late in the cycle. Representative Shawnee, comments. Representative Stutes.
Oh, thank you.
Representative Eastman, comments?
Actually, a question to the chair. I know there was a fiscal note here in our packet for dealing with later from this department. Is there going to be someone from that department to address that fiscal note at our coming meeting?
I'm sorry, as to the nomination of Ms. Dahlstrom?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to know. I mean, we were talking about if there's additional questions for her, and before asking a question, I wanted to know if we're going to have a chance later on to ask her department.
I'm not sure what fiscal note you're talking about, so...
There's a bill before the committee with a fiscal note from the Department of Corrections.
You mean House Bill 52?
Correct. Yeah.
I believe there will be people from Corrections who will still be here as we work our way through that bill.
Very good. Yep. No, my comment would just be thank you for taking this appointment. I appreciate your answers to the committee.
Representative Wall.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I echo the thoughts of Representative Eastman and Representative Kopp that you have a challenging situation ahead of you, I'm sure. I am concerned about privatization, whether we do it here in Alaska or whether we do it vicariously through another state. I think if we send our prisoners out to save money to a private prison outside, I have a problem with that. You said earlier that you think that our system is doing a good job or that can handle the job in front of it. I get concerned when I guess the concept of a private prison is someone trying to make profit and therefore reducing expenses, as in a business would do, and trying to fill beds. Both those concepts I have a hard time with, whether it's in Alaska or outside of Alaska. So I hope we don't pursue that avenue.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. Nancy Dahlstrom, I'm very happy you're willing to take this appointment. It's a big job, a lot's on your plate, and the whole landscape of justice, the reform efforts to do it better, even when we're on the path to success, if we come to a stop, we'll get run over. You know, we just have to keep moving, and appreciate your willingness to step in there. The questions, you know, about privatization, one of the big fundamental issues is just that we're dealing with people, you know, and families and things like that. So for me, it's less of a monetary thing than it is Alaskans being further separated from their communities. And I know that that'll all be on the discussion as we go forward. And, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I, having been someone who's done the tour of Alaska prisoners and interviewing them in different places, the Corrections Corporation of America has been contracting with the state for decades, and I've been to the Corrections Corporation prison in Phoenix and in other areas. So we have had a relationship with private prisons for a long time. It's not a recent thing. But the point still that we're all engaged with is what's the right thing to do by our people, and also as we all are concerned about the budget and how do we weigh those things. So I know you'll be a good advocate for getting at the right balance in that.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, I've known Nancy for about 15 years now. I look forward to working with you as Commissioner of Corrections.
And I'll just note that I actually found it interesting. Our former Senate President made the observation that he thought one area we should consider a constitutional change was in the Commissioner of Corrections, because it's a department that the long range becomes really important, and sometimes the changes that go on from one administration to the next actually makes it more and more difficult for a person in your shoes to do the job, recognizing that some of the things we're trying to do, both in terms of more successes with probation and parole, potentially trying to change the culture of how we treat prisoners that are in custody, that although we like to think culture changes overnight, his observation, and I think he had a point. I'm not sure I agree with him that I want to amend the Constitution to that level, but his point about the challenges that this position calls upon in terms of having a pretty long vision and recognizing changes and importance that those changes actually work, and that we not just sort of flip back and forth from one option to the next and not really get the benefits that come with that longer vision. I think in large measure you're asked to take on a job that really demands a very long vision, because the people that are in the custody of corrections, some of them will be in our custody for quite a long time, and there'll be others that may not be in for such a long time, but they'll be getting out and getting back into the community, and how we deal with those people has a lot to do with how the community continues to function well, and whether we go on a path where people are concerned with rising crime or whether they see that we're making progress to improve public safety. And I think, as you well know, corrections is a big part of that whole package. So I appreciate your coming. I know I sometimes have some hard questions, and you know that, but that doesn't diminish my confidence in your ability to take on this job, and I know we'll continue to look into a couple of these things, but I also really appreciate the efforts your staff has done with the myriad data questions I keep asking, and I know we'll have your folks here in the next while to tell more about what you're learning about recidivism and other things that are happening in the department that are real positive. So thank you very much for coming today. And with that, I would turn to Representative Ledoux.
So the Judiciary Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee and recommends that the following name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration: Nancy Dahlstrom, Commissioner, Department of Corrections. This does not reflect any intent by any members to vote for or against this individual during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation.
So Ms. Dahlstrom's name will be forwarded to the joint session. I think the document will be circulating for your signature as we go on to our next matter. And if you haven't signed it by the time we adjourn, be sure you sign it at that point. Our second and final order of business today is House Bill 52, Crime, Sex, Crime Sentencing, and Parole, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the governor. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to introduce the bill, we have Commissioner Amanda Price from the Department of Public Safety. Well, there she is. We also have Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General from the Criminal Division of the Department of Law And we will begin with Commissioner Price. You're already here. Identify yourself for the record, and you can begin your remarks. And I'm going to ask committee members to save your questions until after they've finished their opening remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Designee for the Department of Public Safety, Amanda Price. Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, it is my great pleasure to be here before you to discuss and introduce House Bill 52, which proposes amendments to current law, amendments which address the absurdly and continuously high rates of sexual assault and sexual abuse of minors in our state. The rape rate in Alaska is 249% higher than the national average. The rates of sexual assault, sexual abuse of a minor in our state have consistently been higher than the national average. And it is with optimism and pleasure that I am before you to introduce some of the proposed fixes to current law that will provide law enforcement with an improved tool kit to respond to and prevent sexual abuse and sexual abuse of a minor, and also to protect some of Alaska's most vulnerable. The bill corrects certain loopholes in the law that have been brought to the public's attention and have received a great amount of public response and deserved criticism from the Justin Schneider case. But in addition to those loopholes, there are additional protections that are included for vulnerable Alaskans. That includes removing marriage as a defense in a situation where one may engage in sexual activity with an incapacitated, incapable, or unaware person. To be clear, engaging in sexual activity with an incapacitated, unaware, or incapable person is sexual assault regardless of the status of marriage between the victim and offender. This bill creates a fix for that as a defense. There is additionally included in the law the expectation, or in the House bill, the expectation that any individual who has been convicted of a registrable sex offense in another state will also be required to register in the state of Alaska on the sex offender registration. For the knowledge of the committee, the Statewide Services Division within the Department of Public Safety manages the sex offender registration, and that division receives approximately 10 to 12 phone calls a month from individuals who are required to register as a sex offender in other states, inquiring about the status of their requirement to register in Alaska. So again, I want to state that so that we understand the impact. That's 10 to 12 convicted sex offenders who are contacting the state in an attempt to ascertain if they must register as an offender in Alaska. And they are, from the perspective of our Statewide Services Division, utilizing the fact that they do not have to register as a sex offender as one of the benefits in moving to Alaska, the state with the highest rape rate in the nation.
Just on that particular issue, for these 10 to 12 calls a day or a week?
No, a month, Mr. Chairman.
Of the 10 to 12 calls a month, are they generally being told that that's a person that would have to register, or generally being told they're a person that would not have to register?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that generally they are told that they would not have to register, because we do not have, right now, the way the law is written, and Kathy Monfried, our Statewide Services Director, is on the line, and she can speak more specifically, but the way that it's written right now, there has to be a direct correlation to the law that they broke in the other state.
Go ahead and proceed. I know I'm making everybody else wait, but occasionally I don't follow my own rules.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So got me off my
sorry
my train of thought. So just to sort of wrap it up, and then Department of Law is going to sort of do the walkthrough of the bill. I believe that the topic of sexual assault is one that really crosses all of the boundaries in terms of all of us identifying with common goals. We know that the rates of sexual assault and sexual violence are astronomically high in this state. I am very pleased to sit before you and strong support of HB 52 and the additional protections that it provides Alaskans. We have, again, Sergeant Jeremy Roop on the line to answer any questions that the committee may have. I've also got Statewide Services Director Kathy Monfrieda to answer any questions that the committee might have. And it's just my pleasure to come before you and introduce this bill.
So before we get to Ms. Schroeder, this is an opportunity if the committee has questions for the Public Safety Commissioner. Representative Ledoux.
So what do you mean by a direct correlation?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think it would be more effective if the representative from the Department of Law were to walk through what the legal ramifications of the convictions and as they how they correlate to Alaska.
Okay.
Any other questions for the commissioner at this point? Representative Eastman, looks like you're trying to decide whether you have a question or you don't.
Thank you, through the
is
chair.
Is that a question? You go ahead, Representative Eastman.
So I noticed in the language of the bill, it specifically references Williams versus State. I was just wondering if you could speak to that reference.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I would defer to the Department of Law as they come up to do their walkthrough analysis.
Very good. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, we'll bring up the Department of Law for the walkthrough analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Ms. Schroeder.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. Mr. Chairman, I was going to, we talked about not wanting to jump around in the bill, but I actually was, when I was preparing this weekend, I noticed that the topics and the sections are actually grouped together in order. So if the committee will indulge me and allow me to skip over Section 1 for the moment, we can get through the bill and I can refer back to the sections that relate back to Section 1, which is the intent section.
Makes sense. Go ahead.
So that would be starting at Section 2, which is located on page 3. Section 2 and 3 refer to removing marriage as a defense to sexual assault when the victim is mentally incapable, incapacitated, or unaware that the sexual act is being committed, as Commissioner Price referenced. It leaves marriage as a defense only in those circumstances where there is consent and the very nature of the relationship is what's criminalized. So, for example, a probation officer, by law, is not allowed to have sex with a probationer unless they are married. So that would be the only time that defense would be able to be used. Sections 4 through 6 refer to online enticement of a minor. We are removing the online requirement. Currently, the statute requires the use of a computer. We do not think that the method of enticement should matter, and that any enticement of a minor should be criminalized. This is the, the committee remembers, the Chris Hansen To Catch a Predator type of situation that Dateline used to run a number of years ago. The next section would be Section 8 on page 4. This is repeatedly sending images of genitalia to another person.
What about Section 7?
Mr. Chairman, that is related to, that's related to Section 13, and okay. The administration is actually going to ask for that section to be removed.
You're going to ask for Section 7 to be removed?
That's correct, and I can explain that when we get to Section 13.
You're going to save yourself from a question I have.
So Section 8 is repeatedly sending images of genitalia to another person. In this day and age, people are often communicating over electronic means, and some people apparently think it's funny or annoying to send things like that to other people. So the classic example would be somebody sends an image, the recipient says, hey, that's not wanted, please don't do that, and the person keeps doing that in a harassing type of nature. So we would criminalize that. That is a B misdemeanor. The next few sections 9 through 12, refer to indecent viewing or production of a picture. So we're doing a lot of things here. So the most common example of things we've charged under this statute is where somebody sets up a camera in a locker room or a bathroom and is catching people's private exposure. They're using those facilities, they're taking a shower or whatever, and somebody is capturing that without their knowledge or consent. So this statute, the underlying statute, is confusing to read. So what we've done here is we've tried to clean it up a little bit. There probably are additional things that could be done to make it clearer. And then we've also tried to break out the conduct. We've broken out the viewing of the picture as well as from the conduct of producing the picture. That's different conduct, and it's punished differently in the statute. So I don't know if members have a chart I sent to Mr. Chairman's staff.
Can we tell you how you want
it? It looks like this.
So I'm getting some hands getting raised, and it was my goal to not take questions in the midst, but sometimes it's worth moderating. So Representative Ledoux, you had a question relating to Section 9.
Okay, so suppose somebody takes a picture like in a locker room without somebody's knowledge, but it isn't of the genitals, anus, or female breast of another person, but it's some other part of their body, their leg, their, you know, what have you, and it's in a locker room and nobody knows about it, or at least the person who should be knowing about it doesn't know about it. Is that okay? I mean, it certainly doesn't seem like it would be okay.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I agree with you, it's probably not okay, but there is no criminal offense that addresses that.
Shouldn't there be?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that would be a policy question for the legislature.
Representative Eastman, you had questions in this area as well.
Thank you, through the chair. So just want to make sure I understand what's going on here. Now that you've set aside or made this distinction between the viewing and the taking, I noticed on page 4, at the beginning of Section 9, it talks about viewing in the state. So what about the situation where we've now, you know, produced this pornography from a locker room, and now we've sent it to someone who's not in the state? Is that, you know, is that now okay, or what? How does the law going to treat this in this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, this statute does not address the distribution of that. There are other misdemeanor offenses that talk about distributing photos with the intent to embarrass. Those are also misdemeanors, and this is not, just to be clear, this is not pornography. This is the private exposure of somebody. So if it were pornography, for example, child pornography, that would be a whole other class of offense.
Mm-hmm. Follow up?
Representative Eastman.
So let me make sure I understand this right. So if I'm producing this, not pornography, but pictures of nude people, as long as I don't show it to someone in this state and I show it to someone outside the state, the producing of these images is not going to be prescribed by law?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, as long as you're producing the image in the state, if you end up sharing it even with somebody outside the state, the act of sharing is occurring inside the state, and there are misdemeanors available that we could use to address that conduct.
Representative Eastman, as to what was going on goes on outside the state, there's a jurisdictional issue. We can't prosecute somebody in California for what happens in California. We have territorial limits on what we can prosecute.
So understood. Follow up?
So, go ahead, Representative Eastman.
So what we're talking about making the production of a picture the crime here, and we're talking about only if someone views it in the state is that production of the picture of the crime, or do I not understand this right? Again, it's fine to talk about sharing it and how that, you know, might trigger certain federal issues, but this is specifically, at least on line 28 of page 4, it is limiting it to a person in the state viewing it, and that's what is, you know, triggering this producing it being against the law, or maybe I'm misreading it.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, again, this statute is confusing to read, so we could be clarifying this. But the conduct that occurs in the state, for example, if the person is producing it in the state and sending it to somebody in the state, so it originates in the state, but the person is in California and that's when they view it, we can't prosecute the viewing in California, but we could produce the production that occurred in the state and the sharing of it that occurs in the state. So any conduct that occurs in the state, we could prosecute, even if it ends up crossing state lines. I just wouldn't be able to prosecute the viewing that occurs outside the state.
That's not quite the point of the question, though.
Well, actually, I think that the way the statute is redrafted to try to clarify some of the confusion is you've created a subsection 1 which relates to the viewing, and subsection 2 relates to the production. And so the example that Representative Eastman has tried to articulate, which is an example that somebody produces a picture in Alaska and then sends it to somebody in California who views it. You couldn't charge that person under subsection 1 for viewing the image, but you would be able to prosecute that person under subsection 2 for production of the image in Alaska.
Correct.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, I'm really confused here because it looks like section 2 only relates to pictures of people under a certain age.
So through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I can explain that a little bit. So the statute talks about who has to give consent. So if the person is under 13, the parent needs to give consent. And if you don't have the parent's consent, then the criminal penalties could apply. If the person is 13 through 16, both the parent and the child have to give consent. And without that, again, the criminal penalties could apply. For the person over 16, just the person over 16 has to give consent. So there's this, and it's confusing to track, but that's what the law says.
Go ahead, Representative.
Where does it say that? I mean, I'm just looking at this, and unless I'm looking in the wrong place, it's not saying that to me.
So on page 5, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, on page 5, lines 9 through 12, that's where the consent issue comes into play. So it says the parent or guardian of a person shown in the picture if the person shown is under 16. So if they're under 16, you need the parent's consent. And if the person shown is is at least 13, then you need the child's consent. So you need double consent for when the person is 13 to 16. And then by default, anybody over 16 would be able to give just their own consent. It is confusing. I agree.
Extremely confusing.
And Representative Ledoux, another feature that's not in the bill but is part of the existing statute, it references in subsection, or actually I take it back, it is if you go down further below, it distinguishes between the Class A misdemeanor dependent based on age of the person that is in the image versus the younger age, so that a lot of the stuff you're talking about gets to what is felony conduct because the person is under 16 and under, or under 16. I may be getting my words confused.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that the reference on line 28, to page 5, line 28, should actually say under 18 because it's still going to be a felony if the person is under 18. So if the person is 17 years old, did not offer their own consent, it would still be a felony. So that's another issue that we would want the committee to try to address for clarity. And again, we are all ears about making it more clear. Just to go back to the chart, we're doing a lot of things in this statute. We've got the consent issue that we've already talked about, but then we're also creating a tiered approach based on what the conduct is and who the victim is. So based on the chart, if the viewing or production is involving a child, it's going to be a Class C sexual felony and a registrable sex offense. If the production is of an adult, it will be a regular Class C felony, so it would be punishable by 0 to 2 years, but also a registrable sex offense. If the viewing is of an adult, it will be a Class A misdemeanor with a 0 to 30 presumptive range, 1 year max. And that's all contained in the chart. It's easier to see.
Other questions? Okay, we can proceed.
That brings us to Section 13, which is on page 6. Section 13 makes it sexual contact for somebody to knowingly cause a victim to come into contact with semen. This has been referred to a Schneider fix, so it refers back to the Justin Schneider case. There are, as the committee knows, there are several bills out there in play right now. The ones that are moving have all taken this particular approach. So anywhere the words sexual contact appear, if it involves knowingly causing the victim to come in contact with semen, that would qualify. So we could be charging a sexual assault in the second degree, sexual assault in the third degree, sexual assault, sexual abuse of a minor in the second, and sexual abuse of a minor in the third, and then also the misdemeanors for both offenses. The next section is Section 14.
You referenced earlier that Section 13 relates back to Section 7.
Oh, yes.
So can you take us back to Section 7?
Yes. Section 7 deletes the word semen from harassment in the first degree. And this is with the intent to harass or annoy, you cause somebody to come into contact with semen. Initially, we had put this section in the bill because we were afraid of a lenity argument by including semen in sexual contact. However, upon further review, we realized that the mental states and the situations targeted by both statutes are different enough that we think that they do not cover the same conduct, and we would survive a lenity challenge. We also believe that leaving it in harassment in the first degree is appropriate for those situations, for example, where a prisoner throws something on a correctional officer, and that's really how harassment in the first degree came about to begin with. It was to address those types of situations.
So the department's perspective is that to the extent this bill or some iteration of it moves forward, the department's request is that Section 7 be removed.
Yes.
And that's consistent with the history that when it was first created, the inclusion of semen in section in that what is AS 1161-118A was specific to, or the initial concern was correction officers and people in a similar situation.
Correct.
And to have a crime that would be available in that circumstance, and to remove that language would actually make it impossible to prosecute some of those situations.
That's correct. And in harassment, again, the mental state is with intent to harass or annoy. And then in the sexual assault context, we have to have without consent, and without consent requires some use of force. And so those contexts are completely different, and so we think the two can survive together.
Okay. That gets us back to Section 14. Thank you for that diversion.
Section 14 is an enhanced penalty for assault in the second degree, which is where we most often charge strangulation. This is, again, targeted at the Schneider case. However, again, there are multiple bills out there all taking different approaches. This is just one, and it's not necessarily the preferred approach. It's just an approach.
Since we've gone to the more questions as we get through these, looking on page 7 of Section 14 under subsection 5, that's referencing AS 1141-210 is referencing assault in the second degree rather than sexual assault in the second degree. Why is it referencing assault in the second degree to create the enhanced penalty and not sexual assault?
It is referencing assault in the second degree to cover the strangulation situation. So if somebody is strangled, that is where we most often charge it, and then it would create an enhanced penalty.
And another alternative in that same place, I think some of the other bills take approach that with an aggravating factor rather than an enhanced sentence.
That's correct. The House bill approaches it with an aggravator. There is a bill in the other body that approaches it by increasing the penalties for all classes of assault when a dangerous instrument is used. So there's just different approaches out there.
Okay. And is the department taking a position as to the three different approaches?
Mr. Chairman, I think anything is better than nothing. They all are good fixes. And some of them could survive if simultaneously. Like, they don't directly conflict with each other.
Okay. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Yep, still on page 6, just we were talking about a moment ago. So I remember one of the prisons that I toured, I was with a friend of mine, actually. And while we were on the prison tour, one of the inmates, you know, threw some semen on her. Under the current language we have in the bill, does that become a criminal act, therefore, that would require that inmate to register as a sex offender?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, under the current language of the bill, yes. However, as Mr. Chairman and I just discussed, we want the section of the bill that forces us to charge it as a sex offense removed so that we have those options to address the harassing type of nature of certain conduct.
Okay, thank you.
Just for clarity, harassment is not a registrable sex offense.
That's correct. So the next section is section 15, and it covers several pages, but the substantive portion of it is on page 9. And this refers to sexual abuse of a minor in the third degree. So what we're doing here, sexual abuse of a minor in the third degree is situations where the defendant is 17 years of age or older, and the victim is 13, 14, or 15. It is currently a regular Class C felony. It is presumptive range of 0 to 2 years. It is a registrable sex offense, however. So what this change would do is this change says when there is 6 years of between the defendant and the victim, then it becomes an actual sexual felony and is subject to that enhanced sentencing range, 2 to 12. We are trying to account for the close in age situations that are, while still criminal, sentenced at a lower offense. But when it gets to the 6 year age difference, it starts to feel a little more predatory, and we wanted to be able to address that by making it a sexual felony.
Question?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. And so 6 years seems like an interesting number. How do we get to that 6 years? That's not a year number that I'm familiar with.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it would be a new age range. That's a brand new age range that's in law. That's just what we selected. If the committee feels that that's too small and it needs to be broader, that's a discussion that we can have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the beginning, you said the ages were 13 through 17 for a what was the first statement that you said, if you could repeat that?
So the defendant needs to be 17 years of age or older, and the victim is 13, 14, or 15, and we're talking about sexual contact, not penetration. So this could cover potentially closer in age situations. I will say, though, that we did pull our cases regarding those close in age situations, and we don't charge very many of them, and when we do, there's usually something else going on. There's usually plying the victim with alcohol or something like that.
Follow up.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you. So high school students, 117, 115, would the defendant, if the defendant was 17 and the victim or you know, other person is 15, that would be a situation where the 17-year-old would be committing a crime if they had sexual contact?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, let me just clarify. The defendant is 17 years of age or older. The victim is 13, 14, or 15, and there is at least 4 years of age difference between the two. So there still needs to be the 4 year age difference.
Okay, thank you.
Which is different than the 6 year age difference here.
Right, but 17 and 15 is 2 years, so it wouldn't,
right.
That wouldn't qualify.
Right.
With respect to these changes, I know you talked earlier about the Schneider case and kind of the public reaction to Schneider. Are there cases involving third degree sexual abuse of a minor that have gotten public attention that people that have caused outrage in terms about how they were prosecuted or not prosecuted or how they were treated?
Mr. Chairman, not that I'm aware of. I think that most public awareness that comes from sexual abuse of a minor in the third degree comes from the special session on SB 54. That's the last time I think that the public was really kind of aware of what was going on there.
Okay, thank you.
The other changes made in this section are conforming. We are making indecent viewing or production of a picture of a minor a registrable sex offense, and so we need to and a sexual felony, so we need to add that language there. The next section is section 16. The substantive portion of it begins on the end of page 11, starting at line 30. And this is the This is the fix to address the Williams case, which is addressed in Section 1. So Section 1 is the intent section. Part of what that intent says is that we want to overturn the Williams case. So what the Williams case said was, when counting prior felonies for determining the presumptive range for a sexual felony, a non-sex felony cannot be counted if the defendant was unconditionally discharged more than 10 years before the current felony. So there is a 10-year look-back period for non-sex felonies. So if you commit a burglary and then you go 12 years before committing another burglary, we can't count that first burglary as far as determining a presumptive range. You would be still in that first range. However, with sex offenses, we have always counted all felonies, no matter how old they are. So if the person committed a burglary 12 years ago and then committed a sex felony, we had always counted that burglary as counting towards the determining the presumptive range. The Williams case changed that. So under the Williams case, if the burglary occurs, if they were unconditionally discharged 12 years before the current sexual felony, we cannot count that when determining the presumptive range. This means that under Williams, sex offenders will be sentenced to lower sentences than they had before. And so the Williams was issued in March of 2018. So from that point forward, sex offenders will receive a lower sentence depending on when their prior felonies occurred. So what we're doing here is we are addressing the Williams case and saying when you commit a sexual felony, all of your prior felonies, no matter how old, come back into play and will help us determine what the presumptive range is.
So I took the time since our last conversation to actually read the Williams case, because I was curious about the analysis that the court engaged in. And they make specific reference to the legislature passing a law that indicated that unclassified and Class A felonies would always be considered priors for purposes of sex offenses. And I think not just for sex offenses, but for any offense.
That's correct. Any offense.
But for Class B felonies and Class C felonies, they talk about how the legislature did not do that that they had allowed a certain period of time. So for example, somebody who's charged with burglary 20 years ago and then gets arrested again for another burglary today, that person would be sentenced as a first-time felony offender for this new burglary because of the passage of time. And with regard to a burglary that was 20 years old, if a person got charged with a sex offense for the first time today, that would, if this law were to pass, we would now be treating that person as a second-time felony for the sex offense, but a first-time felony for the burglary offense today.
Mr. Chairman, in your hypothetical, are they committing a sex offense and a burglary together?
Well, that would make it way too confusing. Let's just say it's two different people. One person has got they both have burglaries that are 20 years old. Person A, the new charge is a burglary 20 years later. Under any analysis, both the old law and the current law, that old burglary doesn't get counted as a prior felony. As to the person that commits a sex offense, that person the old burglary today wouldn't get counted as a prior offense, but if this amendment passed or this law bill passes, that person, the sex offender, would be treated as a second-time felon. The burglar wouldn't.
That's correct.
Do we have any evidence or data suggesting that let me get one other question out before I get to the next one. If that old offense of 20 years ago was a sex offense, that would count as a prior for purposes of the sex offense today.
That's correct.
Would that also count as a prior for the burglary today?
I believe so, but let me check on that.
Okay. But my query is there any evidence that we've seen in terms of criminal history data and behavior patterns that people who commit burglaries more than 10 years ago are somehow greater likelihood to commit sex offenses than than people who have no prior sex offense history, if I'm getting that question right.
Mr. Chairman, I sitting here, I don't have any evidence, like data, for example, but
right.
I can say that it goes to a pattern of behavior. For example, if your first charge, your initial charge is a burglary, and then 15 years later you commit a burglary and a sex assault, it shows an increasing pattern of behavior. And what, under the prior law before Williams, what the theory was is that some criminal history is such a nature that it should count. And that could be based on the prior offense, but it could also be based on the current offense. And the age of the prior felony goes to the weight and not necessarily about whether or not it should or should not be counted as far as a presumptive term.
All right. Well, it presents a very interesting question because I know one of the pieces of information we've been consistently hearing is that statistically sex offenders are actually far less likely to recidivate than property crimes and other crimes that we're hearing a lot of. And so it raises an interesting question about should somebody somebody that is getting convicted of their first sex offense, if they've got a 20-year-old burglary, does that mean we should hold that person in for longer than other people that are also committing their first sex offense simply because 20 years ago? I mean, I don't think anybody has any issues if 2 years before they had their first felony conviction and now they're back in front. There's a pretty tight pattern of what's going on, but I think on these longer sentences, it raises interesting questions. I'm not sure quite the right resolution of it, but it raises interesting questions.
It does, Mr. Chairman, and I guess what I would say to the recidivism of sex offenders, those numbers reflect what is currently in our laws. It reflects longer prison sentences and the containment model that is implemented by the Department of Corrections, which has been widely accepted as being successful. So when viewing that kind of statistics on recidivism of sex offenders, you need to view it in the context from which those numbers come.
Right. Representative Ledoux.
So I guess what you're saying is that the reason we don't see recidivism among sex offenders is because we keep them in jail for so long that they don't get charged again?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I also talked about the containment model that's implemented when they're on probation, and I'm not saying that that's a cause and effect. I'm just saying that when you talk about recidivism rates for sex offenders, you need to look at the system as a whole and figure out what's going on. I don't have any answers on that today.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a population of people that have committed felonies and then, say, 10 years later are committing sex offenses that perhaps compared to other people that are more people that commit sex offenses have a history of a previous non-sex offense felony?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I don't have any statistics on that. Oftentimes you will see a person be convicted of a sex offense and they don't have any prior criminal history. But you do sometimes see an escalating pattern of behavior, like the burglary and then maybe a burglary sex assault, like I said. So a Department of Law doesn't keep a lot of stats, so I don't have a lot of information as far as that goes. But we do see patterns of behavior.
Thank you. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Two questions through the chair. So one, could you just briefly explain what it is, the containment model that you're referring to for the committee? And then also, are there minimum or maximum age limits just statewide and statute-wide as far as who can end up being on this sex offender registry? Like, is there you can't be subject to that if you're below a certain age or above a certain age?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, our state sex offender registry does not include juveniles. I would address any follow-ups on that to Kathy Monfredo, who is online for Department of Public Safety. And as far as the containment model question, I do believe we have somebody online from the Department of Corrections that can explain the containment model and what they do.
I think that is Laura Brooks from the Department of Corrections. Ms. Brooks, are you available to answer that question about the containment model?
Yes, this is Laura. For the record, this is Laura Brooks, Deputy Director for the Department of Corrections. Just real briefly, the containment model is an evidence-based program in which we have specially trained probation officers who monitor the sex offenders on their caseloads in tandem with polygraphs. And so the offenders are placed on a schedule whereby they get polygraphs as they release out into the community, and then as follow-ups during their time on probation and parole. And the containment model, we definitely have seen, as Ms. Schroeder indicated, it's a critical piece to monitoring this population. We are able to identify deviant thoughts and things like that before the offender actually goes into their assault cycle again, and so we're able to change the controls, such as we tighten curfews, we increase the frequency of home visits, the frequency of reporting into the probation office, so that we can try to get that offender back on track before there's actually a new crime or a new victim.
Okay. You can proceed.
So the next section, Section 17 and Section 18, are both conforming changes because we're making certain offenses sexual felonies. We had to change those statutes to reflect that. The next substantive amendments are in Section 19 and 20, and this refers to the sex offender registry. So this would require anybody who is required to register as a sex offender out of state to also register in Alaska if they are physically present in the state. This is also, Section 1 has an intent section related to these sections, and basically this is a matter of comity and protecting the public, and it is not meant to be punitive. Alaska has a very transient population, and so we often get people coming in and out of the state, and we don't want to see Alaska become a safe haven for those who are required to register out of state. If they're going to be here, we want to know they're here, and we want them to register.
So one of the questions about the sex, or actually, did you have a question, Representative Eastman?
Go ahead, I'll ask later.
Go ahead and ask your question.
So one of my questions, I'm trying to just make sure I understand correctly based on what I just heard, was that in the event that you have someone who's, I don't know, a day shy of their 18th birthday, and they engage in the conduct, which we were talking about previously, as sexual assault in the third degree, and that the person that they are doing that conduct with is more than 6 years younger than they are, so 12 or younger, that they are not under this bill or under our current law, they are not going to be required to register as an offender, as a sex offender. Is that correct?
The offender is under 18 at the time.
Under 18, yeah, by a day.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, if the person is adjudicated as a juvenile, they will not be required to register. That's correct.
Thank you.
So it came about in a somewhat circular way, but it has come to my attention in the world of the sex offender registration statutes that there are a number of states that have made public urination a registrable sex offense. And I gather this issue has come up before when similar provisions came up here in Alaska about kind of what are we doing about out of state. And it raised this fairly significant issue because, you know, when I discovered through this research that there are states that make public urination a cause to register as a sex offender, I thought, better not do that in Alaska because it's pretty hard to drive down the highway sometimes without seeing somebody in the bushes going to the bathroom. And while that may be a lot of things, including somewhat offensive to some, it's also kind of hard to think about how in many parts of Alaska you can function without people going to the bathroom outdoors. And that raised that whole question about what are we doing with making anybody register it in another state that we may actually think that conduct really isn't quite so terrible. Are we going to make them register in Alaska? And have you seen anything about this issue about public urination in other states as a registrable sex offense and how that would be impacted in Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, I think I've seen something from legislative research, and I was not able to pull that actual statute. I would want to pull that statute and look at it myself. because sometimes it's not really the act of urination that is criminalized, but it's the exposure of the genitals to commit the act of urination that is criminalized.
Sometimes it's hard to go to the bathroom without exposing some genitals.
But that's. But I would want to look at that the underlying statute to see what they're actually criminalizing and how that may or may not compare to something that's already in Alaska, because I think that the list I saw at least had a few offenses on there that, depending on the circumstances, would be registrable sex offenses in Alaska.
And others that might not be.
Yes, depending on what the circumstances were.
And the other, and how they criminalize it in the other jurisdiction.
Correct.
Okay, Representative Eastman, you've got a question.
Thank you. Follow up to that. So I understand in some other states, I was surprised to hear that you have some very, very young people, sometimes as young as 6 or 7, who are registered as sex offenders. So how would this bill treat someone like that, since we don't do that here in this state, but they're coming from another jurisdiction where they are registered as a sex offender? Do we now require them, because of that conviction, to register as a sex offender here?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, they would have to be convicted of a registrable sex offense. So again, because we didn't change the definition of conviction, and the definition of conviction in Alaska specifically excludes those who are adjudicated as juveniles, the juveniles from out of state would not be required to register either under the way the bill is drafted right now.
Great, thank you.
There was talk, the public safety commissioner was talking about this notion of Alaska being a safe haven. Do we have a number? I mean, are there a lot of people that come to Alaska from out of state that are registering as sex offenders?
Mr. Chairman, that's a question probably best fielded by Kathy Monfreda from the Department of Public Safety.
And I believe she's online. Ms. Monfreda, are you on the line?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I am.
Okay. Did you hear the question that I just asked?
I believe the question was how many sex offenders from another state register each month?
Yeah, well, that's a good place to start.
Great. Mr. Chair, the registry sees about 3 to 4 new registrants per month from another state.
Are you on a speakerphone?
I am.
Can you get off the speakerphone because you're breaking up wildly?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm off the phone now.
Ah, that's much better. Go ahead and answer the question again.
Okay, so the answer is approximately 3 to 4 new sex offender registrants from out of state register each month.
And how many, it doesn't have to be exact, but can you give me a rough total of how many sex offenders we have registered in Alaska today, and what percentage of those, or how many of those are from out of state, not percentage, but numbers of out of state registrants?
Mr. Chair, I think there's about 3,600 sex offender registrants right now. I would have to get back to you with how many of those have out-of-state convictions.
Is it going to be a significant? Is it going to be more than 10% of those are out-of-state registrants?
Mr. Chair, I can't answer that right off the top of my head.
Okay, if you can get back to us, that'd be a big help.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Schroeder, do you have more on the bill?
There is just one final section that is a substantive change. That's section 21 on page 15. So this is the discretionary parole statute, and we are doing a couple of things here. The first thing we're doing on page 15, lines 27 to 31, that language is currently in statute. That's a prohibition on discretionary parole for your serious sex offenses. That's currently in statute. However, it's located in subsection B of this statute, and subsection A talks about the prohibitions, and subsection B talks about who's eligible. So I don't know how that language got in subsection B, but we're just lifting it from B to A so that we have all of the prohibitions in one place and all of the eligibility in another place. So that's really just kind of a cleanup thing for this statute. The other thing we're doing is on page...
You might describe that as more of a technical change,
yes, yes,
than a substantive change.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
I just wanted to make sure the committee understands we're not changing eligibility as far as that language goes. Page 16, lines 1 through 4, that's clarifying language, clarifying that if you are not eligible for a good time deduction from your sentence, you are also not eligible for discretionary parole. So those offenders that are not eligible for a good time deduction are your repeat sex offenders. And we don't think it makes a whole lot of sense to say you don't get good time, but you could be eligible for discretionary parole. So that seems not to conflict with each other, and so we're clarifying that no good time equals no discretionary parole.
Question?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Chair. And is it clear in how this is worded currently that just because I, as an inmate, don't earn any good time because I don't behave well and I don't earn any good time, that doesn't put me in the category of not being eligible for good time?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, do you mean not eligible for discretionary parole?
Well, you've now decided that if someone isn't eligible for good time, that certain things happen. And I wanted to know, if I'm not eligible for good time just because I didn't earn it, not because I couldn't, but because I chose not to, does that put me into that new category that's triggering these things to happen, or is that a separate situation?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, that is a separate situation. There is a reference directly to 3320.010A3, and those are your repeat sex offenders who are ineligible for good time, and therefore they would be ineligible for discretionary parole.
Thank you.
And those are the sections, Mr. Chairman.
Well, what I'm going to go ahead and do, Representative Eastman, tell me what's on your mind, because we're running out of time.
I just wanted to know when we were going to get back to Section 1.
If you want to go ahead and – I know there were some issues in Section 1, which you did. Representative Eastman is correct. You wanted to come back to that and briefly touch on the intent language.
So Section 1 is the intent language relating to Williams v. State, and the fix for Williams v. State was found later on in the bill.
We actually discussed that extensively.
Yes, we did. We discussed that extensively. So that's intent language, just clarifying that the legislature intends to overturn that decision. That intent language of this nature becomes helpful when we start to litigate these things, so that's why it's included in the intent section. The other part of the intent section has to do with out-of-state sex offenders registering, the section that we just talked about, and also clarifying that the legislature intends to overturn the Department of Public Safety versus Doe. That is the recent case that came out that said that if you don't have an offense that's similar, then you don't have to register. So that if that case came out in 2018, we intend to overturn that case with the change to the statute that is in the bill. And the intent section further clarifies that it is not meant to be punitive. It is a matter of comity and protection of the public. So that's what those intent sections do.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for coming and making the presentation. We are effectively out of time today. There will be an opportunity. We have this, I think, back on the schedule for Friday. We also, I think, have it on for public testimony on the bill. So I'm sure we will have folks available at that point in time to answer additional questions we may have. And so with that, we are going to continue to hold this bill for further review. We will now adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Wednesday, March 13 at 1:30 p.m., following the Law Finance Subcommittee meeting, which begins at noon. And with that, we will stand adjourned. It is now 3 p.m.